Vern Lundquist joins us on Sports Byline. He has one of the most recognizable voices and faces in sports after more than 50 years in broadcasting. And he has a wonderful book out about his broadcasting life. It's called Play-by-Play, calling the wildest games in sports, from SEC football to college basketball, the Masters, and more. And Vern turns the spotlight on himself, recalling some of the most important, unbelievable, and even outlandish moments he has seen happen on the field, in the clubhouse, or otherwise over the last five decades. You know, the thing I thought about when I looked at this book, Vern, was how did you get your life and your career into 305 pages?
It was not easy, Ron. It was a collaborative effort. I had back surgery in November, just about a year ago, and it became complicated. And it, I had signed a contract with HarperCollins, and after a couple of months with nothing forthcoming from me, we had a conference call, and they knew the circumstance, but we agreed maybe we had to have a ghostwriter step in. So we hired, we being the publishing house and me, a fellow named Gary Brozek. And so this was a process, book publishing and writing, I'd never been through. Well, Gary and I would talk once a day. I bet we did it 4 days a week for an hour and a half each. And then we called a call center, and they would transcribe the conversation, send it to him. He'd write a chapter, send it to me. I'd fact check it onto the editor, a fellow named Matt Harper. And Matt played a very, very important role in all this, deciding what to include and what to eliminate. And I told somebody earlier today, Nancy, my wife, finished her reading on the airplane coming into Austin. We're in Austin right now, which is where it all started in 63. And she looked at me with a grin, and she said, "That's pretty good." And I said, "Well, if I've got your approval, we're off to a great start." But the guy, and we talked about what to put in, what not to put in. And so we were able, I don't remember what the final tally was, but it pretty well covers most of my life and all of my life in the career I chose.
Well, like me, you had a lifelong fascination with radio. Tell me about that.
I will. And it started very early in my life. We lived in Everett, Washington. My dad was a Lutheran minister. And while we were there, I was four when we moved there, and I was 12 when we left. And every Friday afternoon, he would go to the local radio station. Call letters were KRKO. And he would drop off church announcements. And the same thing was true of the Baptist minister, the Episcopalian priest, the Methodist, the Presbyterian, the Catholic. And they would have a weekend Friday. It was a very broad-based radio station. And they would read these notes and announcements, really. And I went with my dad to the station once, and I was just mesmerized by the setup and what these guys behind the pane of glass with a headset on were doing when they opened their microphone and spoke words to, in that case, I would guess, 1,000 listeners, maybe more than that. So that was my first exposure to it. And then we moved to Austin when I was 12. And in junior high school, I had a three-segment semester. Pretty interesting choices, not mine, the school system. Home economics, typing, and speech. And in my speech class, and I watched my dad in the pulpit giving sermons all my life. So he got me cleared of any sense of anxiety about addressing an audience. And my speech teacher in the eighth grade said, the University of Texas has radio majors. There was no television back then. Now, of consequence, they called me and they want someone to come over and read the part in a tape-recorded play. And these were laboratory projects of a 10-year-old Indian kid. And I recommended you. So now I was involved in it in person. And here again, I was just enthralled with it all.
You were?
And you, I played a 10-year-old Indian kid.
You were involved with some of the greatest moments in sports. And, I mean, it's some that I will never forget, and I know you won't because you wrote about it in the book, including Jack Nicklaus's legendary one-stroke victory at the 86 Masters, Christian Laettner's buzzer beater in the 92 NCAA tournament, Tiger Woods' comeback at the 2005 Masters tournament, and the kick-six Iron Bowl of 2013. Now, I bring all four of those up for a reason. What is the commonality about the truly great moments, whether it be individual or team-wise in sports, Vern?
Good fortune. I think more than anything else, Ron, I think all of us who are blessed to have done what I've done for quite some time, so long, you go to an event, whether it's the NFL, SEC, March Madness, the golf tournament, and A, you hope that something memorable breaks out. And I've been very lucky to have had that happen more than once. And then, and equally significant, I think, you trust your instincts to deliver appropriate commentary that enhances either the listener or the viewer's appreciation of that moment in a way that is appropriate. And here again, I've been lucky in that these moments my call has been made memorable, first of all, because of the team or the guy who accomplished it. But then, you know, the appropriateness, I think, is significant. But most important is to have the opportunity. And then you prepare for that all of your career and trust your instincts.
You know, it's kind of interesting. I was involved in the 82 or the 92 Stanford-Cal game, the one where the pass, you know, the ball was lateraled all over the field. And there is something about anticipation, but when you take a look at the events that you were involved in with the great calls, did you anticipate what was going to happen in any of those, or how did you make it seem so flawless?
The only time I could specifically say probably, but not even probably, would be Jack at 17 in 1986. He toured the beginning with the ninth hole, so it's really the last 10 holes of the final Sunday. And one of the most extraordinary accomplishments I've ever seen in any sport. And he started the day four back of Ballesteros, and Seppi put it in the water at 15, and Jack was in the midst of this brilliant round. And all of a sudden, he was on 17, tied for the lead. So when he stood over the putt, I can remember him watching him walk up and thinking to myself, because we were elsewhere on the court at the time, and Pat Summerall threw it out to me. I remember thinking, this is Jack Nicklaus. He has a chance for the lead. Keep it simple and get out of the way. So in that case, yeah, I did. I anticipated. And my words were appropriate, I think, to the moment.
We have about a minute left before we have to break. What about Leitner's buzzer beater? That was a play and a shot that I'll never forget. It kind of burned into my memory. What about you?
Well, the whole game was a treasure. And Christian was perfect in that game, up to and including, obviously, the last shot in overtime. He was 10 for 10 from the field. 10 for 10 from the free throw and tossed in seven rebounds. The play prior to that was a brilliant shot by Sean Woods of Kentucky over Leitner, as it happens, banked it in. And Kristen, I've talked with Kristen about that night. He was just proud of the fact that they called such a quick timeout. And Krzyzewski in the huddle said, Grant, here's what we're going to do. Can you get the ball to Leitner? And Grant said, yes, I will. Not I can, I will. They had done the same play once earlier against Wake Forest, and the ball curved on Grant Hill, that is, and it went out of bounds. I knew all that afterwards, but the game was many people regard that still as the greatest college game ever played, and I would concur.
Yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly. I think it was one of the greatest college games ever played. Vern, hold on just a second. Vern Lundquist with us and you. We continue on Sports Byline. Vern Lundquist has joined us here on Sports Byline USA. We're going to make his book, Play by Play, the book selection of the month on the Sports Byline Book Corner. And I'm going to tell you, if you want to read about someone's outstanding career, about the moments that they shared of greatness in sports, and also some of the interesting people that he has been involved with, be sure to check out this book. I highly recommend it to you. When you take a look at television as compared to radio, people often ask me about the difference, but I'll let you, as an established professional for such a long time, address that question.
Well, I think it's fairly obvious to any sports fan that in radio you are the eyes of the listener. And more significant to the broadcaster's perspective is that you can take that broadcast any direction you'd like. You do have a producer standing behind you, but he is more of a guy who hands you cards to get the appropriate commercials read. In television, on an average, I would say, let's just take, well, I'll give you a perfect example. At Augusta this year, this is my 34th, the credential list for CBS Sports was 530 people. Now, not all of those are involved in the over-the-air telecast, but we had 54 cameras, and you are really limited by the direction of the director and the producer with replays. So the number one lesson I learned early on, and Ron, you would remember this fellow, a brilliant and very succinct broadcaster named Ray Scott.
Right.
Who came of age as the voice of the Green Bay Packers. And he taught me, we became good friends, and he said, be brief, learn the gift of laying out. Let the producer and the director take over at times. And not at times, but more often than not. But here's a typical, for the young people who are listening, a typical Ray Scott television touchdown call. Star, Dowler, touchdown. That was it. Three words. And I've never forgotten that. Now, everybody in sports television overtalks the moment, everybody. But I'm proudest probably of the moments when I was true to his advice and just shut up. And most memorably for me was the kick six game against all odds. Chris Davis of Auburn returned a missed 57-yard field goal, 109 yards for the winning touchdown, final play of the game. And Gary Danielson and I did not even look at each other. And there were no fingers to lips, like saying, shh. We just shut up. And Steve Milton took over. He's the director, still is, and he also directs the Masters. And he did, I've likened it to creating a visual symphony. Now, the noise factor was off the charts, and half the stands at Auburn were on the field. And for 1 minute and 21 seconds, Steve showed what was going on. And it was elation and defeat, a wide shot, close-up, reaction shot, emotional shot again. And only after that 121 did Craig Silver, our producer, say, let's start the replay sequence. And all I said, coming, quieting the crowd a bit in the microphones, was, well, you might want to see that again. And Gary took over, and simplicity, we only did three replays. And the most memorable line of the last replay for me, Gary had taken us through who was on the field, and Alabama had its field goal protection team on the field. And as Chris Davis was going into the end zone, Gary said, well, no wonder they couldn't tackle him. They didn't have any athletes out there. They're all fat guys.
I remember him saying that, and I was struck by that. The other thing that's important, and you and I both know, is when you hear in your headset, lay out. That means don't say a word from the director.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Yeah, they just say.
Well, and I've got some guys who are active in the business to this day, and I know you'll understand, no names, but they've not let a significant moment happen in front of them that they could not shut up. Gary and I are still very good friends, Gary Danielson, and Brad Nessler, I think, was a wonderful choice. I've known him for more than 30 years. So Gary called me about four games into the season this fall, and he said, so how are you spending your Saturday afternoons? And I said, well, Nancy's as addicted to the SEC on CBS as I am, but we start our day at 10 o'clock Mountain Time, and then when it comes to the CBS game of the day, we put our feet up on the coffee table, turn up the sound, and then I continue to yell at both of you guys.
That is funny. That is a great line. Speaking of the SEC, it's kind of interesting. I understand the story because you talk about in the book, you initially viewed the SEC play-by-play gig as a demotion, but as it turned out, as you actually know, it's one of the most significant assignments of your career. Why did you feel that way initially?
Well, my first NFL season for CBS. Obviously, I think a lot of folks know now, I was the radio play-by-play guy for the Dallas Cowboys. I'll share one for the San Francisco audience. I was on play-by-play in the 82 game, the Dwight Clark catch. And we had many country western fans would remember a group called the Gatlin Brothers. And we had Rudy Gatlin, one of the three, in the booth with us. The intent of his presence was to sing Don Meredith's old song, Turn Out the Lights, The Party's Over. That was going to be sung when the Cowboys had cinched the game. Well, Dallas and his fans are still waiting for that moment. So Larry never got on the air. But the point is, I went to CBS to do college. Then they promoted me. And I did the, in my mind, they promoted me. And I worked with just such an all-star lineup of analysts, Terry Bradshaw, Pat Hayden, Dick Vermeil, Dan Fouts, Dan Dierdorf. I was working with Dan in 99, and we were the number two team, and that's, life is pretty good in the NFL. You get games of significance almost every week, and I kept hearing and reading rumors that Dick Enberg, a Hall of Fame broadcaster, if there ever was one, was unhappy at NBC, and that he was going to make himself available to CBS. And these rumors were whispered initially, but then I read them in a column in USA Today written by Rudy Marksky. And so I thought, I better find out what's going on. And I called my boss, still my boss, Sean McManus, and I asked him about the rumors about Dick. And he said, well, first of all, I don't know if he's really unhappy, but if he is, I owe it to this division to have a conversation with him and see if he has any interest in coming with us. And which caused me to say, well, I don't think he'd be coming, right, unless he was the number one guy. And that slot had been filled for us. So then Sean said, in the unlikely event that we were to sign Dick Enberg, how would you feel about going back to the SEC on CBS? And I said the appropriate things and hung up the phone and turned to Nancy and said, honey, pack your bags for Tuscaloosa. At that point, CBS had made a commitment to the SEC to take what was essentially a regional sport and televise it nationally. And Sean McDonough was my predecessor, and he left, and the job was open. And coincidentally and very importantly, the BCS, I didn't like the system, but I liked the accomplishment of it. It made every game in every part of the country relevant. So what was going on in Tuscaloosa was important at Cal and Stanford, or Michigan State, Michigan. And then, really importantly, in that system, the SEC put together 7 successive national championships. Well, that'll get your attention. And that made what we were involved in so prominent on Saturday afternoons. And I was the guy who rode that horse into the sunset. How's that for a metaphor?
It's really good. Vern, we only have a couple minutes left. I know you're passionate about the Army-Navy game, and I think I can understand having broadcasts from Iraq and Afghanistan and other places around the world with our troops with the show. But why did you choose it as your final college football broadcast?
Well, I have felt since I was a boy very emotionally attached to it, and there was no radio when I was growing. I mean, there was no television. And I used to listen to Bill Stern call that game on radio. And then first time I ever saw it on TV, I was kind of mesmerized by the march in by the cadets and the midshipmen. And in part, it was because of my admiration for the men and women of the academies, their dedication, their commitment to our country. And look at me.
Yeah, I know.
I'm welling up just as I tell the story.
Yep.
Because it increased. I'll share this one. Turn the tide here. Gary Danielson, when we were assigned the first Army-Navy game together, said, "What in the world am I going to talk about up there? They run this triple option offense. They don't throw the ball. I got nothing to talk about." And I said, "Gary, trust me. It will become one of the treasures of your life." And we did the first one, and he shook his head and said, "I can't wait to come back." So that was a very significant thing for me. Roger Staubach said once, when he was quarterback of the Cowboys, and I think most people know that he won the Heisman at the Naval Academy and then served 4 years in the service, he said on a post-game interview with after the Redskins and Cowboys had played in Dallas had won, they said, "Where does this win?" That was a very significant win. "Where does this fit into your career?" And he said, "Almost as important as Navy beating Army."
I know exactly what you mean. I had a friend of mine that was a 4-star general who passed away recently, and we were at the memorial, you know, in Washington, D.C., and on his casket was not only his 4 stars, but below it said, "Beat Navy." And the next day,
of course,
the next day they beat Navy. That was the 21-14, 21-17 game a couple of years ago. And that's how much it means to those men and women. We only have a minute left, so I have to ask you this quick question. And it's the toughest question I have to ask you is, when you think back on your long, successful, illustrious career, is there a moment that's kind of engraved in Vern Lundquist's mind?
I would say that, and here again, I speak of good fortune. But at the top of my list, I've always put Jack Nicklaus winning at Augusta in 86 at the age of 46. And right up there was Christian Leitner's shot in the Duke-Kentucky game. excuse me, Ron. And then the Iron Bowl. I said in the aftermath of that tremendous game, Then I got calls from writers, where do you put this one? And I said, oh, maybe fourth or fifth. And I read a column the next day online, Mike Vaccaro in the New York Post. And his column content alluded to the fact that in his mind, that finish to the Iron Bowl in 2013 provided the greatest finish he had ever seen in sports.
I want to thank you very much, Vern, for your time. You have been an inspiration to a lot of broadcasters, but your kindness that goes along with your talent is something that I will always remember. Congratulations on this book. You are welcome here anytime, my friend. Take care, and thanks for being a part of the show.
Ron, thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Vern Lundquist with us. Check out this book. It's a good one. Play by Play is the name of it. We continue with more of You and Sports Byline.